Last talk of this morning's session will be a review of nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizer efficiency research. And Brian Hopkins is going to present that talk. So, have at it.
Thank you. So about a year ago, I was asked if I would give this type of a talk. There was a survey that was done within the A5 group, and this is an issue that came out on top. And I was asked, and then I said, well, yeah, I would be honored. And then I said, well, would you also be willing to put together the symposia? So the speakers we've had this morning, I intentionally had these folks come, and I want to compliment them and giving a good preface to my talk, that's not why I did it, but some great information that's been had by this morning, and hopefully I will not disappoint. Although I do need to tell you that, we got you here with the title, and as I was preparing this talk, and I'm writing a review article on this subject, I realized putting together this large of a data set was impossible to give. And so I'm just going to be able to, as Paul said, scratch the surface. And mostly I'm just going to talk about my favorite subject, and that's me. So because there's so much data out there, I decided to focus largely on a lot of my work. I have some other things, and I've surveyed the literature, and I've tried to pool that data a little bit in some cases, but I'm gonna talk a little bit of case study from my own experience and background. I'm a little unique. I do have farm background, and until a couple of years ago, had my own little hobby farm, and then I moved from the great state of Idaho, which is truly God's country. Sorry, Tony, but I've been to Ontario and Illinois or Indiana, and Idaho is. Anyway, I moved to Utah 2 or 3 years ago and took a new position. But a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is both scientific and producer from my own family and my own farm experiences, and so a little bit of both in my talk today. All right, so the approach this morning for me is, of course, to identify. We talk about this concept of fertilizer efficiency, and I just did a Google search and came up with 213,000 hits on fertilizer efficiency, and that's in Google Scholar. That's just in the last about 20 years. And so there's a lot of information out there, a lot of scientific data, and I haven't even come close to finishing my review of all that information, although I've done a lot of reading and feel like I have a good handle on at least nitrogen and phosphorus. So when we talk about this, we talk about the problems. I think they've been fairly well enumerated this morning. I'm just going to go over them really quickly and then spend most of my time talking about solutions. And talk about that in terms of some research data, as well as do a couple of case studies. All right, so the problem, again, as I survey the literature, and I've got my file here on nitrogen use, I look at anywhere from 22 to 68% efficiency in the published literature I had. And if you have something that goes beyond that, I would love to get a hold of it. But as I survey the literature, that's what I'm seeing, is that we can have as low as 22% efficiency. And somebody even told me that in some scenarios with saturated soils, it can be worse than that. And my data set is not saturated soils. It's more row crop and dryland soils. Irrigated soils as well, but not rice. Phosphorus use is looking at about 7 to 38% recovery, and that's on a one-year basis. That's of course not what would recycle through the system and come out the next year. But so the question is what happens to the rest of the nitrogen phosphorus that gets applied as fertilizer? And I'm going to focus my talk on mineral fertilizers. Our speaker right after lunch is going to talk about the manure side of this, or the animal waste. And so I'm going to focus mostly on mineral fertilizers. What happens to the rest of these? Nitrogen, of course, a fairly large percentage is lost to the atmosphere, and there's estimates all over the board in the literature. I don't even know that I can even say that there's a consensus. But we do know that a fair amount of what's not used does end up either in surface runoff, in groundwater, or into the atmosphere. Phosphorus, of course, in most situations, it doesn't go anywhere. It stays in the soil. It stays resident there. However, we do have problems in soils that have very high soil test levels. And of course, I would view that as the exception rather than the rule. Now, I realize in some locales that it's the rule where there's a serious problem with that. when we talk about the problems in terms of water quality, we have groundwater issues with a large percentage of quote-unquote degraded waters. That doesn't mean that there's that high of a percentage that are above 10 part per million, but the terminology on EPA website is degraded or impaired waters. And then also eutrophication, hypoxia, when we're talking about both nitrogen and phosphorus, and again, a very large percentage is being degraded. When we talk about air quality, and there's been a little bit of mention of that, and there'll be more later, but that's another issue that's very important. We talk about nitrous oxide, and we hear so much in the press about carbon dioxide. And true, nitrous oxide is being emitted and is found at a lower concentration. However, sources that I read say that it is a far more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. My own perception, of course, it's some of my research in this area, is that we ought to be focusing a little more on nitrous oxide and not just on CO2. Of course, I'd like the funding for that, if anybody has any say in that. So the other thing, of course, is ammonia, reactive nitrogen, atmospheric nitrogen, and I don't spend as much time on that, although we are beginning to measure that more often and looking at ammonia volatilization and that being a concern from particularly insensitive ecosystems in the Rocky Mountains where we're from. We do have researchers in my department even that are studying what happens when we have elevated levels of nitrogen being deposited in alpine zones. So it's not just a water quality problem, but it's also, it can change biodiversity in certain sensitive environments. So those are concerns from an air quality standpoint. And then, of course, we have the manufacturer of fertilizer can potentially result in manufacturer emissions as well. Soil quality, so air and water quality, now we also talk about soil quality. We can potentially have nutrient depletion. And I know many of us focus on that we're enriching the nutrients in the soil, but that's not the case. On average, most soils are depleting over time, and the higher the yields go, the more that's the case. And we see that in surveys that are done of soil testing, that it's a continual depletion overall. And again, some areas are being enriched, but many others are being depleted, and we worry about that. Not so much maybe in the United States, but in certain other parts of the world. We've had the Dust Bowl, we had the Fertile Crescent is no longer fertile. Many examples in history where we've allowed the soils to become depleted fertility and we've lost them. And so that's a concern. Then, of course, we also have a problem with nutrient excess. And where I'm talking about phosphorus today, one of the things is we worry about the impact of both nitrogen and phosphorus on altering ecosystems. It's been mentioned, it's not necessarily something I'm familiar with, but many of you study this, and it's a concern for many. And then, of course, we talk about nutrient interactions, something that Von Jolly and I have researched quite a bit is looking at what happens when phosphorus is excessive. And we can have negative impacts for crop yield and particularly with micronutrient interactions. So that's just a little bit of a brief overview of those. The final impact would be resource. Fertilizers are typically considered a non-renewable resource. And it's, in my mind, that's one of the factors that we should be thinking about in this equation of trying to improve nutrient use efficiency is that we're trying to conserve these natural resources. And I know that's a very debatable, those are some very debatable numbers up there. And again, I looked at a survey of literature and tried to talk to some folks who were in the know on this and said, well, you know, it kind of depends on what happens with technology, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is that at some point, phosphate mines are potentially going to run out. So that's a concern. We have lots of good reasons, in other words, to be thinking about why we should be improving our nutrient use efficiency from environmental and resource conservation standpoints. So what are we going to do for a solution? Some people would like, and as a matter of fact, I think some of those folks might be in the room even. And so I would say, you know, if we think about the good old days and we want to just stop fertilizing, that's probably not a very good solution. Despite what some would say, we would have mass starvation. We would go back to yields and poor soils and conditions that would result in serious degradation to our social well-being because of those issues. So fertilizer is an important component, and I agree with, as Paul talked about and Tony talked about, that It's so important that we be able to find solutions that allow us to continue to have increased productivity and not just ban fertilizer. This was also mentioned, this 4R of nutrient stewardship, the right source, rate, time, and place. I'm going to kind of give some examples of each one of those, but I would also suggest, and again, this has already been brought up, nothing new. Everyone has agreed that there may be more to the equation than that, but I also say there's also the right crop and pest management. One of the things maybe why I was asked to speak is because my research tends to be more systems-oriented, looking at not just a nutrient aspect, but trying to look at pest management as well as other crop management factors. And so I would add that to the list. The other one I would add to the list is the right soil and crop management. And of course, those are inherent, as Paul talked about in his circle of cropping systems, that we have to consider all these things. But I'm gonna try to give you some specific examples of each one of these. And again, I can just barely scratch the surface, but we'll try to do that here in the next few minutes. So let's kind of go backwards up that list and talk about the right crop and pest management. Of course, we want to be able to maximize our efficiency. It doesn't do us much good if we've dedicated a tremendous amount of resources, especially if you're the farmer who owns that field, and you've got the whole thing that has gone to waste because of poor pest management. And so that's an obvious factor that we need to think about. Crop management as well, and I'm going to give you a specific example of some of my work looking at how we can manage a crop and how that impacts nutrient use efficiency as well as some other efficiencies. The other one I would throw into here, and there's more, I'm sure, to the list, but another one I want to give an example of is the genetic differences in nutrient use efficiency, and something that we probably should be focused on as well. So just a quick example, and I can't give you the materials and methods and all the data, so instead I'm just going to try to limit most of these to just one slide and just some highlights of the research. If you want to see the statistics on any of this, I'd be happy to share in great boring detail to you later on one-on-one basis, but let me just give you a few examples. This is a study we did for several years when I was at University of Idaho, looking at bed planted potatoes with drip irrigation. At some point along the way, I asked myself, why are we planting potatoes in rows? And part of the problem with potatoes is that if it gets too hot before the canopy closes, those potatoes get ugly. They grow arms and legs, and they're not worth nearly as much as if they're in that nice little baked potato shape. And so I began saying, well, what do we have to do to be able to close the canopy quicker? And I was trying to approach it from a nutrient management perspective alone and decided, well, that just doesn't make sense. Why can't we just plant the plants closer together and have them close up shop sooner? So we began looking at that, and we said, well, why are we planting in 36-inch rows? And it goes back to when my grandfather farmed potatoes in Idaho, and he was farming with a mule, and his tail end was about that wide. So that's about why we were, we're not farming with mules anymore. We're not furrow irrigating anymore. And so we just said, why do we continue to do the same practice when it's maybe not as efficient? So we started looking at changing the system a little bit. And so we planted potatoes in beds. And the bottom line is that by so doing, we were able to use much more of the space. We increased our plant population by about 33%. We increased the root density. If you go out there and dig, there's not a lot of roots sitting in the bottom of those furrows between potato plants. And so you're wasting quite a bit of soil resource by not using it. And so by putting things in a bed, we increased the root density. We're extracting nutrients and water from a larger percentage of the soil. And that was, both of those are highly significant increases. We were able to reduce our water use now part of that's because of drip, and part of it's because we closed the canopy 14 days sooner than when we grew potatoes in rows. And so we had a net increase in water use efficiency as well, which is a big thing in the West. It's part of the factor in this. Matter of fact, nutrient was not even part of the grant originally on this. But we did increase nitrogen fertilizer. So you'd say, well, that's not good. We're using more nitrogen. Well, that's maybe that's not such a bad deal. If I'm looking at my efficiency in terms of yield, nitrogen per unit of yield, it's actually improved considerably. My yield was about the same in this particular study, but we increased the overall yield. Our yield per plant was about the same. But because we had far more plants, we were able to increase our yield. So we were using a much more efficient system to grow plants. We saved water. Yes, we used more nitrogen, but my nitrogen per unit of tuber went down. All right, here's another, just a brief, I'm not going to show you lots of data on this one, but from the genetic side of the house, a fairly new cultivar, and then some of the, you know, we got the Simplot rep, you know, maybe Simplot doesn't like Alturas as much as they like some of the other, but the potential is there to grow using different genetics to have a more efficient plant that extracts nutrients more effectively. Alturas is far more efficient. It grows a deeper root system, extracts nutrients from farther in the profile, and we can basically grow same amount of potato for a lot less nitrogen, phosphorus, other fertilizers. We get better root mass, and we get a recommended end reduction of about 20 to 40%, which is you know, pretty large. All right, let's talk about soil and water management real quick. We get improvements in, we have interactions with the physical system, pH, microbial interactions are some of the things that I thought of. And then, of course, we want to be able to, especially with nitrogen, but also with phosphorus, we have a water interaction here. And anything we can do to improve water management will likely have impacts on nutrient management as well. Let me just show you a couple of slides here. This is, you know, I'm not going to show you any data, but, you know, here is, this is not Idaho and this is not potatoes. These are corn plants. So I do know what a corn plant looks like. But you can see the bottom ground here, there's water all across there. And we've got, in this case, a product I'm going to talk about a little bit later is polymer-coated urea. But you can clearly see these strips that are through the field of this polymer-coated urea, where we have enhanced the plant's ability to have nitrogen because of its ability to release nitrogen meter it out in a more effective manner. We haven't really affected, you know, the drainage here. This corn is still too wet. It's probably not going to yield nearly as well as the corn up here on the top. But it's one tool that we've used to improve nitrogen use efficiency. Can we also possibly install drains or do other things as far as being able to grow that plant more effectively from a water management standpoint? Absolutely. Another thing we can talk about is in sandy soils. You know, so we have a clay soil example there. We have a sandy soil example. In sandy soils, we oftentimes develop hydrophobicity. And what happens is you get dry pockets in the soil. And if you look at a simulated potato hill here with some actual data from some of our studies, we can see that this hill right here has good uniformity, whereas this one below, these dark red, yellow areas are water deficient. They've become hydrophobic, and within the hill, it's not as we don't have as much water. And the net impact there is the grower sees that, hey, my plants are wilting, time to turn on the water. So part of this is wet and part of it's dry. We end up using too much water. Nitrogen flushes through finger flow and preferential flow, and we end up having more nitrate leaching, more nitrogen use, more water use, and it's a lose-lose situation all the way around. This hill on the top was treated with a surfactant we were working with, and the bottom line is we were able to save not only water and get a better crop yield, but we were also able to have less nitrogen leaching. We reduced, in this particular study, we reduced nitrate leaching by about 27%, which was statistically significant in this trial. Okay. Let's talk about those the other ones as well, the four R's, nutrient placement. We need to be able to understand many aspects of this in order to be able to place nutrients in the proper area to have maximum uptake efficiency. In order to do that, we need to understand how roots grow and look. And my experience is that unless you're a soil scientist, most of the time you don't know what roots look like. And I can't believe how many people I deal with, and they don't ever even dig into the soil and look and understand how a root is shaped. And in that case, you know, where would you want to place it? I talk to growers all the time and say, you know, they say, well, where should I put, you know, where's the optimum placement for the band? And I say, well, you know, think about the way your roots grow. And a lot of them just hadn't even really thought about that perception. Let me give you a couple examples here. This is some sugar beet work that we did, and this is just one field, but it's very indicative of the whole study that we did. But we were looking at nutrient placement, both nitrogen and phosphorus. And in the case of the sugar beet, you know, so we talk about corn and we say, well, you want a 2x2 placement to maximize the plant's ability to intercept the nutrient. Well, in the case of sugar beet, it's a completely different architecture. For the first 2 months, there's very little lateral branching that goes on. It's mostly a taproot, and it goes deep. And so what we found is that putting that band to the side or putting that band too shallow, we didn't get any kind of a bang. But if we put nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizer in about a 6-inch placement, and that's what you're looking at here, you've got, you know, broadcast over here on these two bars. We've got a surface application of UAN and 1034O, a 3-inch deep, and then a 6-inch deep band. But we consistently found over about 4 years of study that by placing the phosphorus in the path of the nutrient and the nitrogen as well, that we had significantly improved yields, but we also had significantly improved nitrogen and phosphorus use efficiency. Another one, again, on going back to my favorite crop, potatoes, you can see here the effect of having a band. This is a check in a fairly high P-testing soil. This is broadcast phosphorus only in the middle bar, and then on the right we have the added band there. And so, what that band does, and the reason I show you this, oops, let's see. I guess I didn't put it there. The phosphorus use efficiency in this particular trial increased significantly. Again, we ended up using more phosphorus, but because we had increased yields, our phosphorus use per unit of tuber was enhanced, and we had less that was wasted. All right, talk about the right rate. Many things that we need to talk about there. We talk about balanced nutrition. I'm going to show you a slide for that here in just a moment. The concept of maximum economic yield, only applying as much fertilizer as what pays. And I'm surprised that the growers that I work with, until maybe a couple of 3 years ago when fertilizer prices went way up, and all of a sudden that became a concept that they wanted to understand more. Soil testing, tissue testing, water testing, for those of us that irrigate, is extremely important for maximizing, getting the right rate, and being able to fine-tune that rate in. And then a variable rate. And let me give you just a couple of brief examples of each one of these. Talk about variable rate. We did a study, and again, lots and lots of data, and I kind of just summarized it to the top nine numbers here. But we looked at a variety of fields over about 5 years, and we kind of lumped them into good soil, poor soil, and then the average soil in the field. And we used the average soil as the benchmark and said the yields and the N rates and the P rates were at zero. And then we applied custom rates of nitrogen and phosphorus based on need. And you can see that we had, in the poor soil, we didn't need as much nitrogen because our yield potential was lower. We did end up using more phosphorus because those poor soils tended to be, the reason they were poor is in Idaho they were calcareous soils, and of course we know that limestone tends to tie up phosphorus. And so we actually ended up having to have more phosphorus in that scenario. Didn't affect our yields much, but we did have a net savings of fertilizer. However, in the good soils, we were tending to under-fertilize those, and we found that we needed both nitrogen and phosphorus at higher rates, and we did increase our yields significantly. So another aspect of getting the rate right, not just for the field, but for management zones within a field. Talk about the balanced nutrition side of rate. Using a combination of the right kinds of fertilizers, if it doesn't do me a lot of good if I'm only paying attention to nitrogen and or phosphorus, and maybe I have a potassium deficiency, or maybe I don't have enough nitrogen. But you can see what happens in this slide. We're looking at nitrogen recovery on the y-axis as opposed to fertilizer nitrogen on the x. And then this is no phosphorus applied compared to plots where phosphorus was applied up here on the top. And you can see that we increase our nitrogen use efficiency tremendously when we have a balanced fertilizer program. So that's another key to the piece of pie here. It's not just a single nutrient looking at that alone, but it's important to look at a balanced program. The right timing. We need to be able to understand nutrient uptake curves, as well as for whatever fertilizer we're using, how that fertilizer releases. Here's some slide. I borrowed these slides from Carl Rosen. I've used them many times, but you can see here on the top, this is a potato nitrogen uptake and growth curve. And typical of most crops, you see a very shallow, a very low nitrogen uptake in the first few days of growth, and then it takes off rapidly, and then tapers off in this S-shaped curve. And again, I'm going to talk about polymer-coated urea. In this case, it's ESN, which is from Agrium. We can see that we've been able to match, or the engineering from Agrium is to be able to match that N release to the potato uptake curve. And I'm going to come back to that in just a second. So the right source, again, we want to look at a variety of things. I'm not going to spend any time talking about these first three, but I am going to talk just a minute about controlled release fertilizers for nitrogen. And I'm going to spend just the last couple of slides on phosphorus. This is the results. Again, just like scratching the surface here. This is some data that we have that's going to be presented by one of my students on Wednesday afternoon, looking at polymer-coated urea compared to urea for ammonia and nitrous oxide emissions, and looking at why maybe we're, you know, why we should maybe pay attention to source. In this particular study, you've got a control. We've got 336 kilograms per hectare here of nitrogen as urea versus a two-thirds rate as urea, and then a two-thirds rate as the polymer-coated urea. And the reason we did that is because in all of our studies, our field studies, we've been able to find about a 67% we can get the same yield at about 67% of the rate. So we kind of come back to the rate thing as well. But you can see here that these two lines up on top are the urea at the two different rates. And you're looking here at the control with the polymer-coated urea, essentially giving the same results. We're getting far less ammonia volatilization over time. And it's not just a snapshot, it's over the entire time. And so we get a tremendous increase in nitrogen use efficiency, partly because we don't have as much ammonia volatilization. If we look at nitrous oxide, same study, we see a similar result, although the shape of the curve is a little differently. But again, the polymer-coated urea is down here. We have very little nitrous oxide emissions. And so from a whatever you want to talk about, I mean, the farmer maybe doesn't care about that. The farmer cares about, hey, I got better yields, which is what he did in his trials. But from an environmental standpoint, we're able to look at this and say, well, this is maybe the explanation or part of the explanation of why we're seeing improved efficiencies. Not to mention the nitrate leaching that we've been able to measure in similar studies that I'm not going to show you. This is the yield data. I probably should have showed this slide first, but you're looking at a lot of data here, but let me just kind of summarize it for you. These four bars on the right is urea that was applied at emergence at different rates, 33 up to 133%. This is the split application where the grower is applying it through the irrigation water on every week to 2 weeks, and then, which is my grower's standard practice. And then this is the polymer-coated urea. And just if you want to focus on one number here, and this is relative to a check, we're looking at that 67% rate of polymer-coated urea giving me my best yields. And that's pretty typical data. This is, you know, again, I'm showing you just the 2006 data, but we've got data from about 5 years now that you know, sometimes it's even, sometimes the yields are the same, never worse, but generally better. So that's a real victory in my mind. All right, and we've also, and I don't want to just plug Agrium, but the reality is that, you know, that's the product that I've spent the most time with. But I've also worked with Georgia-Pacific with Nidaman, Honeywell. I've got a coated urea ammonium sulfate product. I've also done some work with Nutrisphere. And we see some, you know, I guess I don't have some as summary slides because I don't have all those years of data like I do with the polymer-coated urea. But we have similar goals out there with these products as well. Phosphorus, and then I'll sit down, but when we talk about phosphorus, it's a completely different set of chemistry. And we need to, of course, think about placement and whether or not solubility improvements are good or bad. We've been able to add certain things to phosphorus and increase the solubility tremendously. That can be a good thing if it's getting into the plant. It can be a bad thing if it's moving to water. But, you know, that's generally been our goal in our research, is to try to improve phosphorus solubility. And so I'm going to show you a couple of examples. This is a humic acid study, and as soon as I start talking about humic acid, about half the people I talk to shut off. But the reality is that we've been able to document a number of studies that adding a high-quality humic acid to phosphorus and putting it in a band gives us improved phosphorus solubility. And it's consistent. We can apply about half as much liquid phosphate in a band and get the same yield benefit. And that's pretty consistent. Now that's Western soils, alkaline, so it's probably not as good in other soils. But in our soils, low organic matter and alkaline conditions, we've been able to see a tremendous increase in phosphate solubility with the use of humic acid. And what you're looking at here is, this is a check without any phosphorus. You've got 60 units of phosphorus with and without humic acid, and then 120 units of phosphorus with and without humic acid. And yes, those are rates that potato farmers do use, and potatoes are real heavy users of phosphorus. But you can see that, you know, with this 60 units of humic acid, we get about the same yields as when we use 120 units, if we include the humic acid. I'm going to skip that because I'm running out of time. The other one we've done some work with is a product from Simplot called Avail, and we've been able to see some documented increases, particularly when we mix that directly with the fertilizer, and see some increased phosphate solubility. So I'm probably done. I think I'm out of time, right? All right. Thank you.